Yesterday we reflected on the marvelous double miracle, the raising of the daughter of Jairus from the dead and the healing of the woman who had a flow of blood for 12 years. And in both of those miracles, if you remember, Jesus emphasized the importance of faith. Your faith has saved you. Do not be afraid, just have faith. Faith, which opens a space for God to work, and once God works, his works inspire us with greater faith. I mention that because I think it helps us understand today's readings. We can interpret them through this lens of faith, or in the perspective of faith. In fact, it's very clear in the gospel that the problem in Nazareth is lack of faith. That was the last line of the reading. He was amazed at their lack of faith. So he goes to his native place. Mark doesn't say the word Nazareth, maybe because Nazareth had a bad connotation. I don't know why he doesn't say Nazareth. He just says Jesus went to his native place, meaning Nazareth, where he grew up. And he teaches in the synagogue. And the response of the people is quite interesting. They acknowledge that he has wisdom. They acknowledge that he has done and can do mighty deeds. In fact, at the end of the gospel, he cures people of their sicknesses simply by laying hands on them. So they acknowledge that these things happen. But they also acknowledge that they know he's a carpenter and that they know his relatives, his mother and his different relatives. And so they don't accept him. It is amazing. Their lack of faith is amazing. Jesus was amazed. We should be amazed too, or at least warned that it's possible to see the hand of God. It's possible to see his great works and still not submit to him in faith. It's possible. We see it here in the gospel. And we probably can see it in ourselves if we look closely, because God has revealed many wonders to us, great wisdom, and we do not always open ourselves to his power. We do not always give space in our heart to him. So we also can suffer from lack of faith. What is the problem here with these people of Nazareth? Well, they have established their own criteria for how God is allowed to work. They would not put it that way. I'm reading this and reflecting on how they're using what they know as the standard by which to judge Jesus. They acknowledge that he does great things and he has great wisdom. But for some reason, that's not enough. He has to do something more impressive. So, see, they have a standard. They have some kind of a criterion, and Jesus doesn't meet the criterion. Then, also, they have a criterion about social status, and he doesn't meet that criterion either. He's a carpenter, meaning he's only a carpenter. He's not a great rabbi or a teacher. Carpenters can't have great wisdom. Carpenters don't have great power. Therefore, he's not someone we have to accept. Now, where did they get that standard from? They just made that up themselves. They just decided for themselves how God would be allowed to work or not work, or how his representatives are allowed to work or not work. Now, it sounds crazy to us, silly, in fact, foolish, but it's very, very common. Very common. You can pick it up in the discourse in the world. I notice this when people talk about God in relation to the vastness of creation. So a Christian says, well, look at the beauty of creation. Look at the stars. Look at the heavens. They reveal the glory of God. It's a glorious creation. And the skeptic says, well, I look at the stars and I can see that there's millions of stars, and there are millions and millions more stars which we can't even see. And then they say, what rational being, what conscious creator would bother to create all those things that nobody will ever see? It must not be because of God. It must just be random unfolding of natural laws. Well, where did they get that standard from? What gave them the right to say that God can't make things that we can't see? Where did that come from? Came from themselves. It's a decision not to believe. It's a decision not to make space in the heart. And then once that decision is made, okay, then you can prop it up with all kinds of criteria. That's one. Maybe it's not as common as this next one that you'll hear a lot. Here's another criterion people use to prove either that there's no God or that he's not good. They'll say, look at so-and-so's baby. She died when she was 3 years old. Or so-and-so got cancer, you know, when she was two, or leukemia, or some terrible suffering. Now, we recognize those sorts of losses, that kind of suffering, is very burdensome, it's very grievous, and it doesn't make sense to us, yes. Believers and unbelievers know those are heavy, heavy losses. But then they say, well, because that child died at 3 years old, there can't be a good God, because no good God would allow that to happen. Where did they get that standard from? Who told them that that's what God is allowed to do or not allowed to do? They made that up. And we do this all the time. I want to expose this because it's exactly what's happening in Nazareth. It's human standards applied to divine action, or human principles or human criteria boxing in God's power. We don't have the right to do that. Who do we think we are? Who do we think is in charge of the world? Us? Well, yes, if we're in charge of the world, then yes, we can make the rules about what God has to do and what he can't do and whether he qualifies as God or not. But if we do that, we're being very foolish, just like the people of Nazareth. In fact, it's amazing that people could be that foolish. Jesus is amazed at their lack of faith. It says here, because of their lack of faith, he was not able to perform any mighty deed there, apart from some cures. Now, the cures are mighty deeds, but he was limited there. It doesn't mean that he wasn't able to do it. It means that there would be no reason to do it because there's no welcome there. There's no space. So he did cure a few people, and that didn't impress the people of Nazareth either. So even if he had cured hundreds of people, that would not have changed them. No space, no faith. See the problem? The problem is, well, I'll put it this way. Faith is the willingness to let God be in charge, the willingness to let God set the standards and we submit to him. That's faith. And if we don't, if we're not willing to do that, well, then there's all sorts of rationalizations for it. And we can prop up our decision proving that we're right and God's wrong. But it's really foolish. With this idea of faith in mind, with this understanding that faith is radical submission to God and not to our own standards, let's turn to this first reading, which is quite puzzling if we read it without the perspective of faith. This is the story of David ordering a census and then regretting it and then being punished for it. Now, the reason why this is puzzling is because we don't see anything wrong with a census in the first place. We do this all the time. Counting the people is not sinful. There's no commandment, thou shalt not have a census. I mean, that strikes us as being an odd thing to make an issue. It would, in our minds, it would be something like picking grain on the Sabbath. I mean, that there's no moral significance to it. It might strike us also as odd that David regrets deeply having ordered this. I have sinned grievously in what I have done. But now, Lord, forgive the guilt of your servant, for I have been very foolish. This is David, who just a few days ago committed adultery and murder and didn't even think about it. He didn't even notice. He's living with the wife of the man he killed, and he has no, his conscience isn't bothering him at all. Now, well, of course, this is years later, but he orders a census and he feels deeply sorry. I've sinned grievously. What is this? And then after he admits that he's sinned, and he's sorry about the sin, Then the Lord comes up with this punishment. When he committed adultery and murder, and he said he was sorry, the Lord forgave him right away. Why didn't the Lord forgive him for the senses? So all these things could be puzzling to us, and deliberately making it strange sounding, so that we can now reinterpret this with eyes of faith and get the faith lesson from it. So first of all, about the senses, there isn't anything wrong with the senses in itself, but there is something wrong with establishing your own standards and living by them rather than submitting to God. And that's what David was doing. He was counting his soldiers. He wasn't submitting to God. He was propping up himself. He wasn't glorifying the power of God. He was relying on his own power as king and as head of the army. You see the shift there. That is wrong. To turn away from God and to establish your own kingdom, that's the problem. Now, David was not always like that. Remember when he fought the giant Goliath, he said, it doesn't matter how much power I have compared to how much power he has. He has great weapons and human strength, but I'm on the side of God. And David knew that principle by faith, but he slipped out of faith in this decision to grasp his human power. He ends up counting them all, 800,000 plus 500,000, but 1,300,000 soldiers. That's a huge army. Okay, he realizes, I've turned away from God. I have not relied on God. I haven't trusted in him. I'm sorry I did that, Lord. And his conscience is much more sensitive now than it was when he was an adulterer and a murderer. It's not a bad thing to feel deeply that we have sinned grievously, even if it looks to other people like it's not a sin at all. When the conscience grows more sensitive, we realize how terrible sin is. Even small sins move us to deep concern and deep contrition. They should. If you ever read the lives of the saints, you know how deeply the saints repent of their sins, which they barely look like sins at all. That's a more sensitive conscience. So this is what we see in David. And when he says, I've sinned grievously, it's true. Not because the senses is the problem, but because of his decision not to rely on God. And when he says, I have been very foolish, it's true. That is very foolish. Just like the people of Nazareth were foolish to not accept Jesus because of their own human standards and their thinking that carpenters can't do miracles or whatever they were thinking. Now, this strange thing about the three alternatives, it looks to us like God is determined to, he got mad and he's determined to punish David and the people, and it all sounds very arbitrary to us. One way to understand this is to say the Lord was putting a test before David to see if he would once again turn to the Lord and depend on him. Because if there's a 3-year famine, he could do like Joseph did, Old Testament Joseph did, you know, pile up things so that we can survive the famine. If it's 3 months being pursued by your enemy, well, you've got an army of 1,300,000, maybe you could fight this enemy. You rely on your army. But when it comes to the 3 days pestilence, we would call it a pandemic nowadays, but it's a plague of some kind, an illness. But then there's no defense, no vaccine for that one. And David realizes that's the best choice because in that case, I have to rely on the Lord. Having an army of 1 million men is not going to stop a plague. So he says, let us fall by the hand of God, for he is most merciful. That's the right choice. Now, aside from the way it looks like God is being vindictive and arbitrary. That's not the way to look at it. Look at it as the lesson that David was being proposed to David, and he passed that test. Yes, he chose the right choice. See, and this is for us too. In any case, the right response is always to place ourselves in the hands of God. not to rely on human strength or human ingenuity or whatever political powers. Rely on God. Rely on prayer. Rely on faith. Live by faith. That's what he does. And it turns out, yes, it didn't even, it was supposed to be a 3 days pestilence, didn't even last 3 days. God himself was not intent on destroying the people. And David was moved even more deeply to say, I'm the sinner here. I'm the one who should be punished, not my people. See how beautifully David moves back into this space of faith. He's willing to submit himself to God, even to say, I'm the one who deserves punishment, so punish me. That's the humble obedience of faith that we're being taught here. Okay, so yes, David starts out badly, but he realizes it and he repents and he turns again to the way of faith. The people of Nazareth start out with a kind of attraction to what Jesus is doing, but they end up badly because of their lack of faith. The lesson to us is, be like David and not like the people of Nazareth. Recognize, we should recognize our sin and how foolish we have been, repent of it, and turn back to God. That way we won't end up bracketing or limiting the work of God in our lives, and we can more fully participate in his establishment of his kingdom, which is what he wants us to do. He wants us to be instruments of his goodness and grace in the world. That only happens when we live by faith.